Ecumenism, number four. Everything belongs, and no one needs to be scapegoated or excluded. Evil and illusion only need to be named and exposed truthfully, and they die in exposure to the light.
To the light, yeah. That's what we called the Franciscan approach to prophecy, which we called soft prophecy. You don't harangue people, you don't shame people, you don't put, you just do it better. You just reveal the light. You just go live a simple, happy life yourself. And that's your critique of a complex, unhappy life. You don't need to shame people. But my first book on contemplation was called Everything Belongs. Oh, and we used it in that phrase.
Don't even get me started. Yeah.
And for many years, it was my best-selling book. And I always said the reason I thought it sold so well is people love that title. It's like you intuitively know, well, if it's here, if God is allowing it to persist in being, then somehow, on some level, it must belong. And it's my job to find out why and how and to celebrate its existence. That doesn't mean you allow all evil to take course, but it does mean that you're willing to recognize it as evil and work with it. So that's what I was trying to say in that particular alternative orthodoxy. It's a different approach to dealing with evil. And I call God in one of the other of my books, the Great Allower, capital G, capital A, the Great Allower. You can't deny, and it makes us damn angry, that God is allowing an awful lot of stuff that we don't like. And I can't wait to ask God, why does God allow young girls to be trafficked? Mm-hmm. Oh, dang it. This just shouldn't be, you know? But there's some mystery, there's some chemistry to the presence of evil in the world that God sees as allowable. My logical mind does not understand that and does not agree with that. But when my more contemplative mind can say, everything belongs, okay, how do I deal with this? How do I put boundaries around this or protect people from this? Now that's my life task. Not to exclude it, which is the name we weren't going to mention, the political approach of some of our present politicians.
Yes. Sorry.
Kill it, exclude it. That's what Walter Wink would call the myth of redemptive violence.
Right, right.
And Jesus came to reveal to us the myth of redemptive suffering. And again, I'd say we're still, and you know this, in the kindergarten of Christianity, that most Christians still buy the myth of redemptive violence. I use the word scapegoat there.
You bomb us, then we bomb you.
We bomb.
And that the world is made better through a corresponding act of vengeance, violence,
and
or revenge.
And we've moved to the same level of moral development at that moment. That, why can't people see that, you know? I believe Jesus became the scapegoat to reveal the lie of scapegoating.
Yes.
And Rene Girard says that the scapegoat mechanism, I'm sure you've heard this, is the primary principle for the formation of group and culture. You don't have to know what you're for. You just have to know who you're against. You know? Who doesn't belong?
Oh, my
you know,
Lord, that's so
good. Who are the bad guys? So, you know, like, I'll be honest, as a Catholic, you know, up to the Vatican II, that was our great reforming council in the early 60s, we weren't anti-Protestant. We just sort of ignored you as massive sea of heretics who left us in the 16th century, and what a shame, you know? But we didn't criticize you. We just sort of pitied you. Do you understand?
But poor kids. Look at those pathetic kids
who just out there left wandering the mother around church, in the woods. You know? Why would you take them seriously, you know? Now, we could believe that as long as we never knew a Protestant. I went to Catholic schools till my whole life, you know, lived in a little Catholic enclave. But here's my point. Up to the early 60s, Catholicism held together really well. I mean, we were a club. We were a group. We knew who we were. We had our feast days and our saints and our, you know, liturgies and all the rest. Then when the council tells us, well, you know, the Protestants really are brothers and sisters in Christ, and let's get over this need to compete with them or fight them or defeat them. Let's work with them. Since the early 1960s, the numbers of Catholics have been decreasing, decreasing, decreasing. Because we worked well because you were wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once you weren't wrong, and even it changed our whole missionary venture, you know. Once we couldn't assume that all the people in Africa were going to hell, but in fact they were objectively children of God, we lost the power of the scapegoat mechanism. You follow me? Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
so René Girard's principle is true. You're held together by thinking you're superior to someone else, or better than, or, yeah, you're right and they're wrong.
True or right or so, whether it's Protestants, Muslims, immigrants, media.
Pick the group.
Fundamentalists.
Doesn't matter.
Liberals, the elite, those on the coasts. Those in the Midwest, though, whoever it is.
It's always got to be a group. Got to be.
We get it. They don't.
Once you see this, you can never stop seeing it. It's obvious. It's hidden in plain sight. Yeah.
We don't actually know what we're for. We're bonded because we just know we're not them.
We know we're not them. This doesn't take a lot of proof. Yeah.
Right.
It's everywhere all the time. So to gather groups around pure love, to just have a liturgy like they did beautifully here yesterday that just celebrated the presence. It's much harder to gather a group around positive motivation. Listen, you're going to love this. I had, in my living school class in January, a neuroscientist who's also a therapist. You can quote this, and I'm sure you will. He said, we can now prove in neuroscience that anything negative, fearful, or hateful, the mind attaches to like Velcro. Got it.
Really?
And you can feed it for days and weeks and months. But here's the opposite, except for sevens on the Enneagram. All the rest of us, anything positive, happy, joyous, loving, grateful, those are like Teflon. And he said, I can show you the neuroscience for this. He said, if you have a grateful, positive, isn't that beautiful moment? You have to savor it for a minimum of 15 seconds or it does not imprint on the brain.
And negativity prints instantly,
yes. Yeah, isn't that fascinating?
Kristen's talked about that before.
That's Velcro. Positivity is Teflon. And that's why you can walk through the circus or the carnival, isn't that fun, but you actually leave unchanged because you've got to sit and savor, isn't that little child's face delighting in that clown? Isn't that beautiful? You know? And if you don't savor joy, it does not stay
with
you.
And there's a neurological component to
that. That's what he claimed. He sent me the papers on it. I haven't read them yet. They're too complex.
So a daily practice, things you listen to, music, beautiful art, these things you put in your life because you intuitively know you need them.
You have to consciously, deliberately, intentionally love them. That's contemplation, by the way. That's contemplation.
Yes.
To sit there with it and to take it in. And then it imprints a minimum of 15 seconds. Isn't that amazing? Use that all you want. It's helping me teach contemplation because people just nod in recognition. Yes. Why do I hold on to a resentment for 5 years?
Oh.
and looking in my little baby's eyes, which gives me such delight, I don't let that change me, but I let people who've hurt me change me. Yeah. Well, it's a shame. It's demonic almost. I have to ask God about that too.
You got 100 emails that day and 99 were great. One of them was annoying, and that's the one you're laying in bed that night thinking about the one. Instead of laying in bed going, oh my word, that email was awesome, and that email was awesome. It's the one that your brain is like.
I'm sorry to hear that you're that way too. I, as a one, am that way. But I thought sevens wouldn't be. Darn it.
By the way, Richard is referring to the Enneagram.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a sort of...
another alternative orthodoxy.
We should do another... someday we'll do a podcast about the Enneagram. Yeah. But E-N-N-E-A-G-R-A-M. There are 9 sort of... personality
types. Went back to the Desert Fathers. This is not pagan. Yeah.
This is an ancient Orthodox way of understanding how humans move in health and unhealth.
It was a tool for spiritual directors, founded by Evagrius Ponticus, who had 8 passions. He was a Syrian deacon who died in 399. So don't say this is pagan. All right, start it. But again, especially Protestants don't tend to know much about the first 1,000 years.
Right, right, right.
So they call all kind of things pagan that aren't.
Right. Yeah. And the Enneagram, when you sort of understand how you tend to move in the world, and especially if you're in a significant relationship or a marriage, it can be unbelievably illuminating, let alone with
your
kids,
let
alone working with a team of people or a business or...
It's so allowed me to save I don't know how many marriages.
Yes.
I mean that.
Yes.
When he's not doing that personally to get you, that's who he is, and that's who she is. And if you can't love that, don't get married.
And I happen to be a 7 of the 9 types. Richard is a 1, and 7s are excessively optimistic. And generally, you
they're
have
enthusiasts.
We just want if 7 was good, let me have 8. If 11 was good, can I have 14? Just more. Anyway, obviously, as you can probably guess, Richard, the definitive book on this.
No, mine isn't.
One of the better books on this.
Okay.
Is written by Richard Rohr on the Enneagram, E-N-N-E-A-G-R-A-M, spelling it again for you. Now, number 5,